Inner Voice, a heartfelt chat with Dr. Fujian.
Hello, everyone. Hello to Sean in studio, and a big hello to all of you. I'm Dr. Fujian Zain. I'm a psychotherapist and the founder of the Awareness Integration Theory. This is a show about what matters most in our life, our minds, our thoughts, feelings, actions, relationships, our fulfillment in this beautiful journey of life. In this show, I'll bring you the tip of the week about how to mend your heart after an argument with someone you care about. I will talk about where the human will comes from in the Ask Me segment, and I will share the latest research about early life experiences that can have an outsized effect on brain development and neurobiological health. New research is showing those effects can be passed down to subsequent generations, reporting that the infant children of mothers who had experienced childhood emotional neglect displayed altered brain circuitry involving fear responses, anxiety. And then I'm so excited to bring you Dr. Stephen Gilligan. He's a psychologist and the developer of generative change work, which includes the application of generative coaching, psychotherapy, generative trans, the hero's journey, and systematic change work. And he is the author and the co-author of Generative Coaching. So it's an exciting, wonderful, wonderful conversation that I've had with them. Always learn so much from him, and I hope that you do too. I love to hear from you, so connect with me through my website, fujian.com, and follow my social media and message me with your comments and topics of interest. But first, here's the tip of the week. Again, this is the tip of the week. This is Dr. Fujian Zain. And this week, I've been observing all of the relationships that need to be mended after arguments. We can see this with the past political climate when family members, friends, neighbors, and even social media followers, a couple of months of volatile conversations. I also have worked with people this past week that had ended relationships with family members or friends over heated arguments in an impulsive manner and kind of like felt remorse afterward. This happens a lot in marriages when people disconnect after arguments and have no idea how to repair and reconnect. So how do we mend, repair, and reconnect a wounded relationship? I've got 10 ideas for you, right? Steps, the 10 steps. Observe whether you're only interested in reconnecting to prove to the other person that you're right. Obviously that won't work and will only continue to escalate the conflict. 2, clear your intentions. What do you want to create at the end of the relationship? What type of quality do you want to have in your relationship? 3, reflect back to the past argument and behavior and assess what part you played in the conflict and the breakdown of the communication. Identify which one of your behaviors might have hurt them. Would you be willing to take responsibility for how you have hurt them or have created a disconnect in that relationship? Would you be willing to apologize for your part in the disconnection? 7, would you consider having a quality relationship worth more than being righteous about your ideas? 8, would you be interested in seeing the other person's world and have compassion and understanding for their views? 9, reach out the context of reconnection and forgive them for their behavior that has hurt you. And 10, listen first, and then share yourself with love. We can disagree and have different opinions and yet connect with each other with love and understanding. People who report their unhealthy marriages or friendships live this concept every day. We can connect with our similarities and likes and accept our differences. So to learn more skills of observation and intention, creation to go to my book, Life Reset, the Awareness Integration Path to Create the Path You Want. So mend your own heart from disconnecting from people and just because they're not like you. Open your heart and open your ears and open your heart to everyone. You will enjoy the feeling of love that arises from that.
Join the conversation every Monday afternoon at 3 p.m. Pacific for Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Dr. Fujian is a radio and TV host, international speaker, psychotherapist, life coach, and the author of Life Reset, the Awareness Path to Create the Life You Want. She brings you the latest research and interviews with experts in the field of cognitive sciences. Anyone who loves to grow and create growth for humanity gets a voice on this call-in show. Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Monday afternoons at 3 p.m. Pacific on Smart Talk KMET 1490 AM and on KMET1490AM.com.
Hey, here's Dr. Fujian again. Ask me in the Ask Me segment. Thank you for asking me. Now, Florence has asked, where does the human will come from? Well, Florence, I'm going to tell you from some a perspective from some of the scholars. So will generally is the faculty of the mind that selects at the moment of decision, a desire among the various desires present. It itself does not refer to any particular desire, but rather to the mechanism responsible for choosing from among one's desires. Within philosophy, will is important as one of the parts of the mind, along with reason and understanding. It is considered central to the field of ethics because of its role in enabling deliberate action. Britannica says, free will in humans, the power or capacity to choose among alternatives or to act in certain situations, independently of natural, social, or divine restraints. Free will is denied by some proponents of determinism. Arguments for free will are based on the subject experience of freedom, or on sentiment of guilt, on revealed religion, and on the universal supposition of responsibility for personal actions that underline the concept of law, reward, or punishment, and incentive. One of the most amazing philosophers that I've read his book, and I really believe in what he says, Sam Harris, in his book, Free Will, says the idea of free will cannot be mapped onto any conceivable reality and is incoherent. According to Harris, Sam Harris, science reveals you to be a biochemical puppet. People's thoughts and intentions emerge from background causes of which we are unaware and over which we exert no conscious control. Every choice we make is made as a result of preceding causes. These choices we make are determined by those causes and are therefore not really choices at all. Sam Harris also draws a distinction between conscious and unconscious reactions to the world. Even without free will, consciousness has an important role to play in the choice we make. Harris argues that this realization about the human mind does not undermine morality or diminish the importance of social and political freedom, but it can and should change the way we think about some of the most important questions in life. The other side of it is also look at what is choice, because I think sometimes we take free will and choice and put them together, and I think they're different. Let's define choice as an event that occurs in which a decision point is reached, regardless of how many apparent choices one has, they always reduce to one decision. In addition, we may recognize that certain choices may eliminate other choices from further consideration of selection. So, but the actual conversation of free will and will and choice becomes, we are born into certain parameters that you don't have a choice beyond those parameters. So therefore, the concept of free will, as if I have the will to change anything, does not appear biologically accurate. However, within the constraints of the walls, let's say, that I have, or the choices that I have, or looking at the choices that are in front of me, then I get to choose which ones I'm willing to take on and behave toward. The same way as you don't have control over all the thought process that shows up. That's not in your control. You can't tell yourself, I'm going to will myself in order not to have them. You can't. They just show up. However, you do have a choice based on what shows up, in which one of them you can continue thinking about, or you can act on them. So that's how the distinctions that I understood from all of these philosophers and I've experienced in my own life. So I hope I answered your question, Florence, and everyone else who had it. Experiences can have an outsized effect on brain development and neurobiological health. New research is showing that those effects can be passed down to subsequent generations, reporting that the infant children of mothers who had experienced childhood emotional neglect displayed altered brain circuitry involved in fear responses and anxiety. So this study appears in Biological Psychiatry, Cognitive Neuroscience, and Neuroimaging. It was published by Elsevier. So the results show that our brain development is not only shaped by what happens in our own life, but is also impacted by things that happened to our parents before we were even conceived. The researchers focused on brain connections between the amygdala, which is the central to processing fearful emotions, and two other brain regions, the prefrontal cortex and anterior cingulate cortex. Both areas play a key role in regulating emotion. Babies whose mothers experience childhood emotional neglect have stronger functional connections between the amygdala and the cortical region. After controlling for mother's current stress level, the researchers found that the more emotional neglect a mother had experienced during her own childhood, the more strongly her baby's amygdala was connected to the frontal cortical region. Physical abuse or neglect of the mother were not correlated with a stronger connectivity. The findings suggest that childhood emotional neglect has intergenerational effects on the brain structure and function. The significance of the stronger connection remains unclear. The neural signature we observed in the one-month-old infant of emotionally neglected mothers may be a mechanism that leads to increased risk for anxiety, or it could be a compensatory mechanism that promotes resilience in case the infant has less supportive caregivers. In either case, emotional neglect from a mother's own childhood seems to leave behind a neural signature in her baby that may predispose the infant to more readily detect threat in environment almost from birth. Our finding highlights the importance of emotional support early in life, even for subsequent generations. The findings add to the evidence of the intergenerational consequences of early life adversity, such as maternal neglect. Future studies that follow children longitudinally will help us understand the functional significance of these changes in brain function in terms of the emotional and social development of children of mothers who experience neglect. I really request from all of you who have been abused, neglected as a child, to take care of yourself, to get help, to heal. And by that healing, you are also going to change the plasticity of the neural network. And maybe that also results in, when you have a child, that is changes for your child and the generation to come. So taking care of yourself, healing yourself, not having to suffer with all of that, and not having to kind of extend it to the next generation.
Join the conversation every Monday afternoon at 3 p.m. Pacific for Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Dr. Fujian is a radio and TV host, international speaker, psychotherapist, life coach, and the author of Life Reset, The Awareness Path to Create the Life You Want. She brings you the latest research and interviews with experts in the field of cognitive sciences. Anyone who loves to grow and create growth for humanity gets a voice on this call-in show. Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Monday afternoons at 3 p.m. Pacific on Smart Talk KMET 1490 AM and on KMET1490AM.com.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dr. Fujian Zain, and I'm so excited to have Dr. Stephen Gilligan. Is a psychologist, the developer of generative change work, which includes the applications of generative coaching, generative psychotherapy, generative trans, hero's journey, and systematic change work. He was one of the original NLP and Ericksonian hypnotherapy practitioners. This work unfolded into his original approaches of self-relations and generative self, and then further in collaboration with Robert Dilts into generative coaching. He has taught in many different cultures and countries over the past 30 years and has published extensively. His numerous books include The Hero's Journey, A Voyage of Self-Discovery, which he co-authored with Robert Dilts, and the classic therapeutic trance, The Courage to Love, The Legacy of Erickson, Walking into Two World, and Generative Trance, The Experience of Creating Flow. And his forthcoming book is Generative Coaching. Welcome to the show.
Fujian, hi. Great to be here. It's not my first time, but it's great to be back.
Yes. My experience, for anyone who wasn't with us the last time, is my own experience with you, not only as a human being and a fellow therapist, but also as watching you do work with clients, is the utmost level of acceptance and love. Like, this love exuberates from every cell of your body and takes over the space of your clients or the person who's working with you, and even just being around you, there's this eminent love and respect, and I just want to honor you for that. Like, wow.
Thank you. Well, having carefully considered the alternatives.
That's true. So I listened to one of your workshops that you had in Evolution of Psychotherapy. You talk about transforming the problems that someone experiences into a solution, but as a resource. And you take the negative emotions that show up and in a way honor them, that they are there and they're present. I know that most of us, naturally, as a human being, we try to fight it or say that it's not supposed to be there. And even as therapists, a lot of times we'll tune in order to alleviate it, take it away, and as soon as possible. And your approach is different. Can you share a little bit with that?
Yeah. Well, it's really, you know, I've had many great teachers and mentors. I always consider Milton Erickson, the great psychiatrist, hypnotherapist, to be my mentor of mentors. And that was really the heart of his approach that he created over 50 years, that whatever is in a person's experience, you start with that and you make positive use of that. And this idea that everything has equal capacity to be destructive or constructive, depending on the human connection with it. So when we encounter these significant, intense, negative experiences, we're seeing two things. One is there's some core human pattern there. And it's really important because it insistently, you know, keeps asserting itself regardless of the best efforts to try to suppress it or get rid of it. And, you know, we have a saying, if you can't beat them, join them. So we see that at the heart of all these problems are these important core resources. And if we can develop this relationship with it that is positive and curious and kind-hearted and skillful, then that very thing that seemed to be the worst thing in a person's life can actually turn out to be the best thing.
There's a duality here, which is there's a pain or a suffering that the person wants to let it go. At best, what I've noticed is people try to tolerate it. You know, it's not like an accepting it, but they attempt to tolerate it. And the space you're talking about is very different than tolerating it. Can you share a little bit of that experience of the acceptance and love and the hospitable place that you talk about with being with that emotion or the symptom that shows up?
Well, you're using the word duality, and really to get into this creative state of transformation, we say it's a non-dual state. And, you know, so we're thinking in the following way. Everything that we know as reality, we're actively constructing. Everything. There's not some independent world out there. We are actively creating it. And this is sort of the convergence of a lot of different traditions and neuroscience and psychology and philosophy. That doesn't mean we're just doing it from our verbal mind or primarily as individuals. So it's not that, oh, I have cancer, that means I had negative thoughts. It's much more interesting than that. But consciousness is creating reality through many, many, many different levels, you know, through our ancestors, through the history of consciousness. Most of the time, we're not in a truly creative state because we're on automatic. You know, most of the time, the stuff that's being created is just automatic renditions of what has gone before. Okay? So some of those things are outdated. You know, like Milton Erickson used to say, the way that you understood love when you were 4 years old changes maybe when you're 12, and then changes again when you're 20. And then once you're 40 or 50, you better be understanding love in a way different than how you did it at four. So sometimes these problems develop because we have outdated creative patterns. Sometimes these problems get created because all of these expressions are coming from basic human needs. Like, we all have a need to be close to other people. And so, you know, you'll see it as a 4-year-old to say, unconsciously say, I want to hug my mommy, or I want to hug my daddy. And they go and say, I need a hug, or I need to climb up in your lap. If the human presence, the parent in that case, says, oh, come here, sweetheart, and draws that need into a loving human relationship and connects with it for a while, so that child can be able to experience and develop ways of understanding how to get that need met, then you have a positive resource. Mm-hmm. Let's say you had that same need, that same 4-year-old, and says, I need a hug, and goes to climb up on the lap and gets pushed off, or the parents are caught in depression or anger, or they, you know, got their own stuff, and they push the kid away and get cold. That human connection, that negative human connection, is what gets wrapped around this core resource of I need warmth and human connection. And that becomes its representation. And so now I have this sense in my body and mind, asking people for intimacy is bad. I don't deserve it. I can't get it. If I ask people for it, something terrible will happen. So now that need doesn't go away, because it's just vital to every human being. It goes underground. And it starts being expressed in non-human ways. I can't get it through human connection. I'll get it through non-human connection. Maybe that means drugs, or maybe alcohol, or maybe I get addicted to the internet, or you know, maybe I just while away in depression. So what we see at the heart of those symptoms is that they're core basic human needs that will continue to assert themselves all through your life. So you can't get rid of them.
I'm also hearing, based on what you're saying, is that as the human need shows up, and then because it wasn't fulfilled, then there's another set of, let's say, strategies, coping mechanisms comes in. Do you sense that every time the need shows up, because this way of mechanism is also associated with it, that they all show up at the same time consistently? Or is there a separate space also between the original need and the coping mechanism?
Well, the coping mechanism, I think, we can see this so clearly, is that when a person goes into the negative version of that experience, I want warmth, I need a hug, I can't get it, they go into what we call neuromuscular lock, that there's a shutdown in the system. And that takes the experience away from the present moment. It takes it away from present consciousness. And now it's going to act out without sensitivity, without human connection. And so you get what Freud called the repetition compulsion. So that negative state is becomes sort of quasi-independent. And then it activates this sense that you learned from the outside, this part of me is bad. This part of me has no place in the world. And so if I want to express love for my family, if I want to be a good person, if I want to be accepted by the social community, I have to really try to get rid of that quote unquote bad part of me. Mm-hmm. So what we're looking to do is any attempt to try to change it is like throwing gasoline on the fire. Think of it as a young child or a puppy or a cat or a horse. If you in any way are negative or upset to any of those vulnerable mammals, is that they will contract further. So what I learned from Erickson is the first step to transforming or healing or changing is to stop trying to change it. This isn't then something you're doing up in your head. This is where we have to cultivate the state underneath dualism. But before the world gets good versus bad, there's a place. You know, one of the great lines in one of the Rumi poems is, there is a field beyond right doing and wrong doing. I'll meet you there. Yeah. So there's a place before good versus bad, before this dualism. That's where we do the work from.
And that's where the generative concept shows up. That's the space where it can generate from, versus everything else goes into habitual space.
That's right. So that's the first platform. It's necessary, but it's not sufficient. So you got to get there. And people think, wow, how am I going to do that? Well, that's what we look at practically. When do you feel most connected in your life? Because everybody's got something. You know, so we ask these practical questions. Hey, when you really need to make a good connection with yourself. You know, you've been working 40 days and 40 nights. I think I need to get back home to me. What do you do? And they're usually simple things that don't cost, most of them cost no money. You know, I go for a walk. I go sit at the beach, I garden, I cook, I read books, I play with my pets, you know, the usual suspects. Well, now we look at when you go into those special states, the states that really work for you, your special places, does your verbal mind that's trying to control the world one relationship at a time, does it increase or decrease? You know, people say, oh, I start calming down. Are you more or less in control? Well, that's a funny question because I'm not thinking in terms of control. I mean, I'm in control, but I don't feel like I have to control. And then finally, in those states, when you're gardening, when you're listening to music, when you're, for me, it's like reading books is one of my main ways to get there. Is that where does your sense of self end? And people all act like they're Italian. They start talking with their hands. So this is the starting point. But most of the time we think, oh, I can only get that under optimal conditions, which for a lot of people means there's nobody around. When I'm in these ideal conditions, then I can let down my guard and get into that open presencing state. So what we're doing is saying, no, it also is very crucial for any transformation, any healing, any time you're in a place where you feel I want to create further in my life. That's the starting point.
So the space of coming to a space, as I hear you, where you are fully connected with you first, right?
Sorry?
You're connected with yourself first, right? And so then first you get connected, and then that connection also begins connecting with the world.
Yes.
Beyond you.
Yes, which is you.
Which is you.
Yeah.
And then from there's a space of generative creativeness where you visualize or you conceptualize what is the next thing of moving toward. Is that what I'm hearing?
Or what is it that you want to invite into that resilient, safe space that you want to be able to work creatively with? So it could be an old negative emotion, it could be a negative habit, it could be a positive goal that you're struggling to fulfill. Could be, I was working with somebody the other day, and her goal was, I really want to improve my intimacy in my marriage. You know, so what positive reality do you want to create? And this is the first level for creativity. You know, so and what we're doing is tracking, because it's you have to get there first before you ask yourself to do anything challenging. Again, look at athletes, look at creative performers. This is what they do. Now, before you ask yourself to do a challenging performance, remember all the training that you've done to get yourself into a positive performance state. Okay. Then you have to track it every moment. You know, if you're working with somebody, you could see what a lot of times you can get there away from the problem. So you say, okay, that's the problem. Tell me about some really positive parts of your life. Oh, I love cooking. You know, what do you do? What's your favorite thing to cook? What do you like about it? What are the smells? What are the dishes you like to make? Breathe that through. That allows you to get that positive state. But as soon as you say, so let's come back to the problem, you're really noticing carefully, because oftentimes that's where they start to lose that state again. And so getting people to recognize, I need to get into this positive state, and I need to track it because it's really easy to lose it. So if you can do those two things, whatever methods that you have, and most people have methods, they're just not working. You know, that they've got some decent technical methods, but the problem is they're not able to stay fully present and connected to their creativity as they go through the method.
One of the things that shows up for me, as you were talking, this showed up. I, let's say it's challenge, this concept of what do I eat that is not good for me and yet it's tasty. And I've had a background of abuse, so I disconnected from my body for many, many years.
Yeah.
So then it was okay, then let's connect. And then part of the beauty of connection had to do with food and taste. So that would be one way of connecting with my body.
Yeah.
And then obviously it still had the construct of, okay, well, anything for me that is tasty, it's also frightening and doesn't work for my body. So then it was this this challenge of constantly, you know, gaining 25 pounds and losing and gaining and losing. And it was okay, you know, kind of moderating it. And as you were talking, and I brought that into like experiencing my own world as you were talking and see how it fits for me. And it showed up for me as if when I go into, oh, I want to take care of my body, I go into the taste part versus the whole part.
Yeah.
As if I'm not asking all of my body, what is it that I want? I only ask what's the pleasure of taste that goes into connection. And therefore I'm creating, the duality again, versus coming from where you were talking about. Can you share what comes up for you as I share this for you?
Yeah, I think you've just described that process very well, of these unconscious negative habits. So, you know, we all have needs, as I started to say, you know, and all of our creativity is organized around our needs. And, you know, the basic needs like sleep and food and connection and rest and, you know, curiosity. There's relational needs that we have to belong to a family or a group, or, you know, to have friends. There are, you know, what Maslow called these self-actualizing needs that are unique to humans. I have a creative interest in being able to bring something into the world in a new way. So I started to say the positive way that we learn to express and experience those needs is they unconsciously pop out into human relationship. The people in that relationship, when we're younger, that's our family, see them, they reflect them back in positive ways. They create a holding place, so we get blessing for them, and then we get supported in how to be able to express them in positive human ways. But if you say, well, my body needs, you know, to be seen and recognized, but instead you go through, which I'm sorry to hear, Fujian, that there was some abuse there, then your body, particularly at a young age, locks down. It's disconnected from your social cognitive, your sort of your avatar or your politician, I say, that walks around in the world. And it still says, I need connection. So you learn food is my best bet to satisfy this need for connection. And it's automatic. It's automatic. So what we're doing with the coach state, that first state of a positive well-being, is we're grounding. Coach, we use that term coach because it's an acronym. We get centered, open, sort of slow down and feel the flow of awareness. We feel positive connection to our core, our intention, and all the resources, the people and places and beings that really love us and want us to be happy. Right? And then we're hospitable. We welcome whatever's there. Right? So you say, well, something's happening when I go to connect with my body, where I'm automatically doing all this addictive food behavior. I probably tried to change it, you know, stop eating junk food or whatever it might be. And it hasn't worked. So plan B is let's open a place where we can welcome that part of us that's doing that, listen to it, honor it, and invite it to be able to satisfy that same need in a number of different ways. I use that to stop drinking alcohol. And you think, okay, well, that's nice. But, you know, my ancestors are from Ireland. You know, for an Irish person to stop drinking alcohol, it's a miracle. And my father was a violent, fall-down alcoholic. His father, my grandfather, Irish grandfather, I was sure because I had my professional life and I never drank when I was working, that I had no problem with alcohol. I just drank at dinner 2 glasses of California Chardonnay. And I went through a very painful divorce after a 20-year marriage. And I started drinking 3 glasses. I realized at some point I have a problem. I told myself, stop drinking alcohol. And we got what we call Irish finger signals. So I said, okay, this behavior is coming from somewhere. I don't really understand it, but I'm sure it makes sense. So let's take the time to go into this, what we call a coach day. Then let's get the negative behavior, in this case, it was drinking alcohol, and make what we call a somatic model. Let's take away all the words because the words are so judgmental and they bias things. Just strip away all the words and say, represent it like a simple body movement, which be something like this, right? Now what we want to do is slow things down and go through that with rhythm, repetition, and resonance. Those are kind of the 3 characteristics for making something generative. So I want to understand what it is my inner being is trying to create when I'm doing this, right? So I'm not going to do it quite as slow as I did it, but just so I could smell it. This was 15, 16 years ago. I could still smell the cold Chardonnay. I could feel the glass. I feel it coming up. And when it gets to about right here, it's like these little beings inside say, oh boy, alcohol, yay! And so just sort of witnessing that, and I could feel as this is in my imagination, when the alcohol hits my tongue and it hits the back of my throat, there's this warm, beautiful feeling, which I think is there in most addiction. I feel, you were talking about non-duality, I feel this oneness warmth of total surrender. And I can hear my voice say, I would do anything for this. So that's what we call the positive intention. You know, rather than saying, well, stop doing it, or it's not rational, or you don't have to do that, we can't change it from here. It's coming from a deeper language. But if we create a safe place and allow it to just have rhythm, resonance, and repetition, and then bring this sense of, I'm sure this makes sense, my inner self is trying to create something positive. Let me appreciate it, acknowledge it, welcome it, and then invite it to begin to develop new ways to do that, that in Milton Erickson's words, fit the needs of the present self. You know, so maybe when I was 16, 17, that was the best way that I could achieve that warmth, you know. But a lot has happened since then. So now we get to update and say, I have this need, what the alcohol, what the problem, what the symptom has taught me is that I have this non-negotiable need to feel warmth and surrender. And if I don't every day find ways to satisfy that need, the alcohol will always be there. You know, that's why I tell people, your addiction will always be there. You know, use it as a teacher. See what it gave you. Recognize the damage that you had to go through, because in order to be in that addiction, you had to defile yourself. You had to dehumanize yourself. You know, you can see when people are in addiction, the shame or, you know, the damage where you realize that you have really damaged everything and everybody that is dear to you. But you were willing to do that at that core level because the need was so meaningful. So let's invite the need. Let's create a safe place. Sense what the need is, and then ask your creative mind to generate new ways to be able to get that, in this case, that feeling of spiritual surrender, spiritual warmth. And I haven't drank since that day, knocking on wood, you know.
As you were talking, it dawned on me that as I've worked, you know, with addiction for 30 years with myself and others, that actually my clients started getting better when I accepted that it's okay for them to be addicts for the rest of their life.
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you.
Like, as a therapist, when I actually accept it, it's okay. And yeah, then, well, you know, that obviously went toward them. And then, you know, they from somewhere else, not from a fighting of I can't do this, but from somewhere else, it began like, okay, this is not, no longer works for me. But that's exactly what had happened when
that's right. So, you know, all these core words like love or acceptance or trust or boundaries, they have 10,000 different meanings. And as we go through our life, we have to keep realizing the meaning I had yesterday may not be the best meaning for me today.
Yes. Can you tell us a little bit about the upcoming seminars and workshop that you have? It's going to be about generative coaching, right? With Robert Diltz.
Yeah. So, well, I do. I always have many workshops upcoming. StephenGilligan.com, check it out. But the one that I'm doing with Robert, which is a virtual conference, is February 11th through 14th. We have done, Robert Diltz and I were students together at University of California at Santa Cruz. That's where I did my undergraduate work. We were in the very first NLP groups. I went to Stanford for a graduate school. I had a sharp break from the NLP world. Robert continued on to become one of the luminaries. After about 25 years ago, I know it because our kids were young. And so I can date it from how old my daughter was. She's 28 now. So we reconnected and we started doing this joint teaching, and that evolved into this joint work that we call generative coaching, which is how to coach creativity for individuals and groups and businesses. And we have this 15-day certification program. And this 4-day virtual course is the first module. It's a standalone, but it's really exploring what is it to be able to train yourself to be creative in every context of your life.
Generative coaching, everyone. Generative coaching 2021 with Steve Gilligan and Robert Diltz. Online workshop, February 11th to 14th. It's 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. Pacific time.
Pacific.
Four day. And you can find it at stevegilligan.com.
Stephen. Stephen with a P.
Stephen. That's Stephen. We'll put it under your name here so people yeah. have that. Yeah. And I can tell everyone, you will love it. I mean, I've learned from you so much. Every time I've watched your work, then I'm sure that anyone who has not been, I'm sure the ones who come have experienced you, they're going to constantly come back. But the ones who have not experienced your work, that it would be amazing. And Robert, I mean, I've watched Robert Dilts, and he's also amazing. Anything in 1 minute, anything we haven't shared that we really, really want everybody to know?
Just that this is a practical work that is available to everybody. You know, there are certain places for each of us that sometimes we need a little help from our friends. You know, if we can't stay in our positive connection, but basically we're saying everybody's life is a creative journey. And what the work is looking to do is help people find the tools and find the connections so that every day when you wake up, you can think, this is going to be a great day. And at the end of every day, that was really interesting. I didn't predict 95% of that stuff, but what a great day. Let's get some rest, do it again. So that's, I think, especially now at these times, because we live in, you know, I just turned 66. I've never had a year like this last year. I mean, I've never been in a year for the world. And I was in San Francisco in the 60s. And so we need these technologies, these communities for deep creative change. That's what the work is looking to do. We hope that you can join us.
Absolutely. So everyone, please join Dr. Gilligan in generative coaching with Dr. Gilligan and Robert Dilts, February 11th to 14th. Please go to Stephen, S-T-E-P-H-E-N, Gilligan.com to get that. Thank you so much again for joining me. And I always learn from you, and I kind of like bathe in this amazing experience of love and acceptance from you all the time. So thank you. Thank you for taking your time in this busy time that I know you have to be with us. And
can I end with a Rumi poem?
Please.
These are all the Coleman Barks versions. The breezes at dawn have secrets to tell you, don't go back to sleep. You must ask for what you really want. Don't go back to sleep. All night long, people are walking back and forth across the threshold where the two worlds meet. The door is round and open. Keep waking up, folks. We need it.
Thank you. For everyone, create an amazing life for yourself and everyone around you. And until next week, bye-bye.